Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Harbrock. First on this week's program, Mays may probe Pinal County attorney over signal use, discrimination. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on February 6th. The story is part of the Arizona Watchdog Project, a year-long reporting effort led by New Times and supported by the Trace Foundation, in partnership with Deep South Today. Earlier this year, Phoenix New Times reported that MAGA-aligned Pinal County attorney Brad Miller had hidden official communications by using the encrypted messaging app Signal, including, at one point, to whine that Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays should go away. On that score, Miller may not get his wish. In a brief special session on Friday, the Pinal County Board of Supervisors, which oversees Miller's agency, voted unanimously to ask Mays to investigate Miller over several issues, including possible criminal violations. Miller and the all-Republican board have also been at loggerheads after he didn't seek board approval after signing a 287G agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement last year. After convening an executive session on Friday, the five-member board voted to refer to the Arizona Attorney General's office regarding the Pinal County attorney's alleged misuse of public monies and resources and failure to retain public records. Miller and his office have not replied to requests for comment, while a spokesperson for the Attorney General's office declined to comment on any potential investigation. Those allegations relate to a notice of claim filed late last year by a former county attorney employee. As first reported by New Times, the woman alleged that she was sexually discriminated against, worked without pay for several weeks, and was forced to resign in late October. She also claimed Willer's office treated other female employees in a similar fashion. Additionally, the notice of claim said that Miller and his chief of staff, Jeremiah Brosowski, used Signal to elude Arizona public records laws. At a press conference at the Arizona Capitol in January, Miller told New Times that he and his staff did not use encrypted apps such as Signal and denied that he had the app on his phone, though he declined to show New Times his phone to prove it. New Times subsequently viewed screenshots of numerous Signal messages in 2025 between Miller and a member of his staff. Miller's Signal account even used the seal of the Pinal County Attorney's Office as its icon. Those screenshots also showed that Brosowski had his own Signal account and administered a group account that was set to delete messages after an hour. In response to a public records request by New Times for all of Miller and Brosowski's communications on Signal, Miller's office denied that it had any such records. Arizona law requires the retention of public records, and the destruction of them is a possible Class 6 felony. The board's outside counsel, Joe Canefield, told the board that these matters were revealed through the investigation that was undertaken as the result of unauthorized hires by Miller's office. Those are issues that are handled by the Arizona Attorney General's office, said Canefield, former chief of staff for the late Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich. He said the referral was made necessary because they revealed themselves in the manner that they did, plainly and clearly against the law. During the session, the board also unanimously voted to compensate two unnamed employees who worked for Miller's office without the prior approval of the board and were not paid for the time they worked, hence the alleged misuse of public monies and resources mentioned in the referral. According to sources familiar with the referral, the board is also asking Mays to investigate the unauthorized use of a database of criminal histories maintained by the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Sources tell New Times that this likely occurred when Miller had people working for him who were not yet on the county payroll, utilizing the system under someone else's login. Permitting such unauthorized access is a potential Class 6 felony under Arizona law. But former Pinal County attorney Kent Volkmer, who served for 8 years before Miller defeated him in the 2024 Republican primary, was aghast at the allegations against his former foe, including possible unauthorized access of criminal histories. "I can tell you DPS would not be happy with that," he told New Times. "They would have jumped all over us." Nor did Volkmer approve of Miller's alleged use of Signal, which he said his office never used. "It's plainly and clearly against the law," he said. "The public records law is pretty darn clear. It's not even debatable." Many, including Miller, may be tempted to frame the referral to Mays as part of the current tug-of-war between Miller and the board over his office's 287G agreement with ICE. The board recently declared the agreement null and void, citing a legal opinion that said that the county attorney's office lacked the authority to enter into an agreement without the board's approval. Miller, who clearly relishes the attention he's been receiving over the fight, has said that the agreement remains in effect. The board, which said it faces potential liability and financial costs as a result of any agreement, has since authorized its counsel to sue Miller's office and seek an injunction halting the agreement's implementation. Supervisor Stephen Miller, no relation to Brad or the identically named Donald Trump advisor, told New Times that the county attorney's actions had forced the board's hand. "We're supposed to make sure everybody's behaving themselves, but if we don't, we have no recourse," the supervisor told New Times. "It's unfortunate that the accusations that have come out in these employment cases have risen to a level that we feel that they should be sent to the AG's office." Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on February 6th. Lawsuit: DPS troopers, sheriff's deputies, sicked dog on stroke victim. Just more than a year ago, Bradley Page was driving on Interstate 10 toward Casa Grande when he suffered a severe stroke. He managed to make an emergency stop on the highway shoulder, where police soon found him in his 2024 Nissan sedan. But responding state troopers and the Pinal County Sheriff's deputies did not help Page or swiftly transport him to a hospital. Instead, according to a lawsuit filed in Maricopa County Superior Court this week, the cops treated the 62-year-old black man, quote, "like a dangerous felony suspect," unquote, shooting him with stun batons and sicking a police dog on him. As a result of the canine deployment in particular, Page suffered serious injuries to his arm on top of the lasting effects of his stroke. His lawsuit names the Arizona Department of Public Safety and the Pinal County Sheriff's Office as defendants, as well as 4 DPS troopers, a sheriff's deputy, and a sergeant with the sheriff's office. Page is suing all the defendants on negligence grounds, arguing in his suit that officers should have recognized the most obvious signs of a stroke and known the difference between acute medical emergencies and criminal behavior of drug intoxication. He's also suing for intentional infliction of emotional distress and assault and battery. His wife, Doreen, also a plaintiff in the suit, is suing over a loss of consortium with her husband. The pair is seeking a variety of damages. "Law enforcement used extreme and unnecessary force against Mr. Page," his attorney, Benjamin Taylor, said in a statement to Phoenix New Times. "We are seeking justice for his family." DPS spokesperson Bart Graves declined to comment on the ongoing litigation, while the Pinal County Sheriff's Office didn't immediately respond to a message about the matter. Page's mid-drive stroke occurred on February 3, 2025. Officers from the Gila River Police Department were the first to arrive after Page made an emergency stop on the shoulder. Per the complaint, the Gila River officers understood that this was a potential medical emergency and had weapons drawn only as a precautionary measure. Not long after, a DPS trooper identified in the complaint as Jay Harries arrived on the scene. Without properly assessing the situation, the complaint says, Harries rushed to the erroneous conclusion that the situation warranted being treated as a high-risk stop. The complaint alleges that Harries admitted he had not seen Page well enough to have a sense of what was happening in his car. Harries directed other troopers to stop traffic and block the car. He and others pointed guns at Page, who was leaning back and forth in a sporadic motion in the front seat of his car. At that point, the complaint notes, the DPS troopers should have clocked that Page was having a medical episode. Dizziness and loss of balance are classic, well-known symptoms of acute stroke that any trained law enforcement officer should recognize, the lawsuit says. Dogbite. Instead, the officers allegedly amped up the temperature. Harries ordered Page to turn off his car, roll down the window, and stick out his hands. Because Page was in the throes of a stroke, the complaint read, he struggled to comply and instead inadvertently caused the wheels of his car to spin, leading it to become stuck in the gravel. Another state trooper, identified as A. Wheeler, fired two 40-millimeter foam batons at Page's window. The batons are considered less lethal weapons and are meant to achieve pain compliance, though they can be deadly in certain circumstances. Page managed to stick his arm out of the window, the complaint says, only for Wheeler to fire two more batons, striking Page's left arm. Unable to fully perceive what was happening as a direct result of his stroke, the complaint says, Page retracted his arms and tried to roll up his window. The effects of the ongoing stroke caused him to roll his window up and down sporadically as he tried to process what was happening and protect himself from further assault. Wheeler then fired again at Page, this time deliberately aiming to break the window. The complaint quotes an incident report in which Harries described Page as appearing to be in an altered state and shifting from side to side in his driver's seat and mumbling things. New Times has requested that report from DPS, but has not yet received it. Instead of recognizing stroke symptoms, Harries assumed Page was attempting to barricade himself and called for canine and SWAT teams from the Pinal County Sheriff's Office. This decision escalated an already dangerous and inappropriate law enforcement response to what was and should have been recognized as a medical emergency, the complaint says. A deputy with the sheriff's canine unit arrived at approximately 7 p.m., though the complaint does not specify how long it had been since Page made his emergency stop. The deputy, identified only as Sanders in the complaint, observed Page drift in and out of consciousness. And though Page was not becoming aggressive toward any of the officers in any way, Sanders deployed a dog to remove Page from the car. Page's left arm bore the brunt of it. The dog bit Page and violently held on to plaintiff Page's left bicep with its clamped jaws. Multiple officers approached the vehicle to confirm that Page was unarmed, though they didn't retrieve the dog. They tried to pull Page from the car, only to realize that he was still wearing his seatbelt, which they had to cut free. Once Page was finally removed from the car, the complaint says, officers released the dog and forced Page's face to the ground, handcuffed him, and searched him, finding nothing of note. After holding him in the back of a police vehicle for more than an hour, officers eventually transported Page, still in the grip of a stroke, to Chandler Regional Hospital. There, Medical providers confirmed he suffered a stroke, according to the lawsuit, which also says blood tests revealed that no illegal substances were in his system. The complaint says that as a result of the incident, particularly the use of a police dog, Page suffered sustained, permanent, and disabling injuries, specifically to his left arm. The dog bite left 4 penetrating wounds, as well as soft tissue damage, a hematoma, and injuries to his tendons, nerves, and arteries. Page was also charged with failure to comply with a police officer and reckless driving, though both counts were dismissed on January 28th by the prosecutor in Western Pinal Justice Court, according to court records. Woman who survived fatal Scottsdale Airport plane crash sues city. This story was written by Zach Buchanan and posted on February 6th. Nearly a year ago, a private jet owned by Motley Crue singer Vince Neil veered off the runway during landing and crashed into another jet at Scottsdale Airport, killing the pilot and injuring several others on board. Neil was not on board at the time. The survivor who was on the plane, Las Vegas resident Ashley Roziel, is now suing the city of Scottsdale over the crash. Rosalie claims the airport, which is owned and operated by the city, negligently allowed another aircraft, a Gulfstream G-200, to park in a spot that put it in the path of the Wayward Gates Learjet 35A, in which she was a passenger. The lawsuit notes that Scottsdale Airport is among the top 10 busiest single-runway airports globally, handling around 166,000 takeoffs and landings on an annual basis. The lawsuit adds, a reasonable municipality prevents collisions between planes by ensuring that parked planes are kept at a reasonably safe distance from the airport's runway and taxiways. The lawsuit also names as defendants the pilot of the Gulfstream, Southwest Jet Center, which towed the other plane into its position at the time of the crash, WW Aviation LLC, which the suit claims owned or controlled the other jet, and JetPros, which allegedly managed the other jet on WW Aviation's behalf. One day after Roziel filed her suit, a related suit was filed by an insurance company representing JetPros. That suit also claims that Scottsdale Airport and Southwest Jet Center improperly parked the Gulfstream that was hit. Additionally, that suit claims that the company that owns the Learjet, the Neil-owned Chromed in Hollywood, should have deployed a drag chute upon landing. Phoenix New Times has sent requests for comment to Southwest Jet Center, the attorney for Roziel, and a representative for Chromed in Hollywood, but has not heard back. Ryan Saba, an attorney for JetPros, declined to comment, as did a Scottsdale spokesperson. New Times was unable to locate contact information for WW Aviation. Roziel and JetPros insurer, Alliance Global Risks, are both seeking a variety of damages in their respective lawsuits. Alliance says it paid $5.5 million to cover the loss of the Gulfstream. Object-free area. At the heart of both lawsuits is what is called an object-free area, or OFA. As Roziel's suit defines the term, an OFA is a ground area surrounding runways, taxiways, and taxi lanes that must remain clear of all above-ground objects, except for those objects necessary for air navigation or aircraft ground maneuvering purposes. An OFA's purpose is to provide safety by preventing collisions between aircraft and obstacles such as parked aircraft, vehicles, and/or equipment, including when a landing jet veers off the runway at landing speed. Veer off the runway at landing speed is exactly what the Learjet carrying Roziel did on February 10, 2025. The jet, which was flown by 78-year-old pilot Joy Fitosky, along with a first officer, and which also carried two dogs and another passenger besides Rocille, approached the runway for landing at 2:38 p.m. The plane suffered a left landing gear separation, with the landing gear not in proper position, causing the plane to skid left off the runway and over a taxiway before colliding with the Gulfstream parked outside a hangar. Vitosky was killed, and the first officer was seriously injured. Rosile's complaint says she exited the aircraft with the two dogs and helped direct the other passenger to emergency personnel. Rosile, who says she lacked health insurance, claims she suffered physical injuries that, despite being labeled as minor in the complaint, cost her $108,000 in medical care costs. Rosile's lawsuit contends that the other plane should never have been parked where it was. It claims that Southwest Jet towed the Gulfstream G200 from inside a hangar to its spot at the time of the crash, so a third-party audiovisual technician could have better ambient lighting to install recreational video screens in the plane's passenger cabin. That spot, on the northeast side of the runway, was unreasonably close to the runway and in an OFA, the lawsuit says. The suit also claims the Gulfstream's owners, operators, and pilot should have known it was dangerously parked, and the Scottsdale Airport's air traffic control tower, which had a clear line of sight to the Gulfstream G200 plane, should have noticed and had the plane relocated. No drag chute. Whether the Gulfstream was indeed parked in a dangerous spot is unclear. Google Earth satellite images from a span of several years show planes parked similarly close to the runway, as does a photo of the crash, included in a preliminary accident report released last year by the National Transportation Safety Board. Notably, the report makes no mention of object-free areas, instead focusing on the malfunction of the Learjet's landing gear. The final NTSB report has not been released, and the investigation into the crash is listed as active. However, a detailed map of the airport on the Arizona Department of Transportation website shows an orange line marking an object-free area that passes very near where the Gulfstream was parked. Whether it was indeed over that line, in whole or in part, is not entirely clear based on photos in the NTSB's report. But the suit brought by Alliance, JetPro's insurer, also claims that the Gulfstream was parked inside the object-free zone, going on to say the planes regularly parked there. According to that suit, the Federal Aviation Administration requires that OFAs be 800 feet wide and extend 1,000 feet beyond the end of each runway. By contrast, it says Scottsdale Airport's OFA is only 630 feet wide. In 2016, Scottsdale asked the FAA to make an exception for its narrower OFA, which the FAA approved in 2019 under several conditions. One of them, the lawsuit says, was the adoption of a new ordinance that no person shall park, leave parked, or allow to remain stationary any aircraft at the airport except within an aircraft parking and storage area. That ordinance was never enacted, the suit says, nullifying any exception to the OFA dimensions granted by the FAA. Despite the fact that the modification was never effective, the city proceeded with airport operations as though it was, including continuing to lease airport space located in the OFA to Southwest Jet Center for use as aircraft parking, the suit says. The Gulfstream was parked outside Southwest Jet Center's hangar at the time of the crash. The suit also faults Neil's company, and by extension, the deceased Vitosky and his first officer, for not deploying a drag chute when landing the plane. The suit references findings in the NTSB report that the Learjet had a hard landing in June 2024 that caused its main left landing gear tires to burst. Though the damage was repaired, and the plane was inspected multiple times between then in the February crash. The suit claims the plane's operators were aware of gear issues. Specifically, the suit claims that the Learjet's cockpit voice recorder captured discussion about the Learjet regarding strange noises heard by its occupants, as well as discussion about the landing gear. That should have prompted the pilot to deploy the drag chute, which, the suit says, would have provided significant deceleration to the point that the Learjet would not have crashed into the Gulf Stream. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on February 5th. Stanton demands answers from ICE on detention center measles outbreak. Measles has found its way into Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facilities in Arizona. And four Democratic members of Arizona's congressional delegation are demanding answers from ICE about the extent of the outbreak. So far, three cases have been attributed to ICE detention centers in Florence. In a February 5th letter addressed to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and ICE Acting Director Todd Lyons, Representative Greg Stanton, and three other Democrats requested detailed information regarding cases. The three other signatories, Senator Mark Kelly and Representatives Yasemin Ansari and Adelita Grijalva, did not respond to requests for comment. But in an interview with New Times, Stanton responded, "Hell yes," when asked if he's worried about the disease spreading among detainees. "How are you going to isolate these people? Where are they going to get medical treatment? Who's providing that medical treatment?" he asked. "We need to know the answers to that." The spread of measles, which is one of the most contagious diseases on the planet, is very dangerous in a setting like a detention center, Stanton said. ICE needs to be as fully transparent and answer tough questions about how they're going to handle something as dangerous as a measles outbreak in their facility, he added. In the letter, the representatives outlined 24 questions for DHS and ICE about the current status of the outbreak and how they're managing it, including questions about medical care and vaccinations, protecting the other detainees, and ensuring access to legal representation. The Arizona representatives requested a response by February 19th. Measles is a highly contagious disease that can spread rapidly in congregate settings, the letter shared with New Times reads. It is critical that your agencies act swiftly, transparently, and in coordination with federal, state, and local public health authorities to contain the outbreak and prevent further spread. On January 16th, the Pinal County Public Health Services District confirmed it had identified a positive measles case stemming from an individual in federal custody. The district has since confirmed 2 more cases, all involving individuals in federal custody, district spokesperson Yasmin Castro wrote in an email to New Times. On January 21st, DHS confirmed that one case involved a Mexican citizen held at an immigration facility in Florence, but hasn't disclosed where the other 2 cases occurred. 2 measles cases were reported at the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Texas by the Texas Department of Health Services on January 31st. Citing privacy laws, Castro declined to share further details about the individual's facilities or locations, including which centers the cases occurred in. CoreCivic, which owns and operates the federal facilities in Florence, directed New Times to ICE and DHS. CoreCivic spokesperson Brian Todd added that all detainees have daily access to sign up for medical care and mental health services, and that the facility works closely with local hospitals and providers. In a statement, an unidentified DHS spokesperson said, "Medical staff is continuing to monitor the detainees' conditions and will take appropriate and active steps to prevent further infection. All detainees are being provided with proper medical care." Castro added that the district is working on contact tracing and with partners to reduce the spread, but the overall risk to the community remains low, which would make sense considering the positive cases are locked behind barbed wire. However, Stanton said he's concerned about the outbreak spreading. This affects not just this facility, of course. It affects all of Arizona when you have an outbreak of this nature, Stanton said. This is a real issue, and ICE owes a lot more explanation about how this happened and what they're going to do about it. Measles in Arizona. The outbreak in Florence comes as Arizona is facing its largest measles outbreak in decades. Since August 2025, nearly 260 measles cases have been reported in the state, most of them concentrated in the remote community of Colorado City, along the Arizona-Utah border. But recently, positive cases have been identified in Maricopa, Pima, and Pinal counties. This year has already seen 34 positive cases. The last huge Arizona outbreak occurred in an ICE facility. In May 2016, an outbreak hit ICE's Eloy Detention Center, topping out at 31 positive cases, 22 detainees, and 9 staff. Staff contained the outbreak by vaccinating all but one detainee with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine within 3 days, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Measles, which spreads through the air, is highly preventable with 2 doses of the MMR vaccine, which is 98% effective. If an unvaccinated individual is exposed to measles, there's a 90% chance they'll contract the disease, which can lower the immune system and lead to deadly side effects like pneumonia and encephalitis. While measles was considered eliminated in the U.S. in 2000, it came back full force in 2025. Unfounded concerns over vaccine safety have gone mainstream, thanks to the appointment of vaccine misinformation guru Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. MMR vaccination rates have dropped below the 95% herd immunity rate in Arizona. Stanton has already faced pushback from ICE over past efforts to conduct oversight of ICE detention facilities. In July, he was denied access during an unannounced visit to Eloy Detention Center, which is expressly allowed by law. At the time, Eloy staff cited a DHS policy against surprise visits that has since been struck down by the courts. Stanton is optimistic that DHS and ICE will respond to his letter, but he added, "We're not naive. We know that the administration has not always been responsive when Congress has exercised our legal rights," Stanton said. "We're not going to go away." Stanton also said he plans to keep a close watch on the recently and secretly purchased ICE detention center in Surprise, adding that ICE didn't receive any input from local leaders or the surrounding community before buying the property. The building itself is light industrial, which makes it far from ideal to have human beings staying the night there, he said. He's also concerned that the facility lacks adequate safety features, including sprinkler systems, emergency exits, and ventilation, to protect the 1,500 detainees ICE wants to house there. If they can't even answer basic questions about how they're handling a breakout of measles in one of their existing facilities, Stanton said, that's not going to get the people in Surprise very excited about having a mass 1,500-bed facility where you could easily have a breakout of measles. The program continues now with this story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on February 3rd. GOP lawmakers' rape question derails Arizona Senate hearing. As far as polite conversation goes, questions about vaginas, anuses, and rape probably fall a good bit short. Monday, at the Arizona legislature, one such question caused quite a ruckus. The incident took place during a meeting of the Arizona Senate's Military Affairs and Border Security Committee. Members of the public had packed the hearing room to express their displeasure with a number of Republican-pushed immigration bills, particularly one from far-right state senator Wendy Rogers, that would set aside $20 million, essentially to pay towns to build their own border walls. Immigration activist Albert Rivera, who has also pushed for continued court oversight of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, was one of those who spoke against the bill. Standing at a microphone, the 20-year-old argued that the money allocated in Rogers' bill should be spent on other issues facing the state, calling the bill a waste of time and un-American to the core. He also accused lawmakers of caring only about following the Trump agenda. Rivera had said his piece and moved away from the microphone when GOP State Senator Jhené Champ, a red Trump was right about everything Stanley Tumblr in front of her, summoned him back to answer a particularly graphic question. "Sir," Champ began, "do you know what it's like to be in the operating room with a 23-year-old woman who's been tied to a tree and raped so much that you can't tell the difference between her vagina and her anus? Do you know what that looks like?" While Champ didn't name the woman, Rivera and many in the room assumed she was talking about the murder of 22-year-old Augusta University student Lakin Riley by an undocumented man who had entered the country illegally. Riley's death has been used by many Republicans as a talking point to clamp down on illegal immigration. Notably, as many on the right have pointed out ad nauseum, Riley's killer was caught and released by border agents after entering the country illegally, suggesting a lack of border wall may not have been the problem. It was an odd question, but Rivera mustered a response. "I feel sorry for that woman who died, and by no means am I trying to justify anything that guy did. It was horrible what he did," Rivera told Champ. But he added, "the fact that you continue to use that as an excuse is disgusting." Champ began to ask another question after saying, "That's not what I was referring to." But Rivera began to walk away again as others in the hearing room told him he didn't need to engage in a graphic tit-for-tat with Champ that had little to do with his testimony. Then things boiled over. GOP Senator David Gowan, the committee's chairperson, piped up and pointed at Rivera, telling him that he needed to stand at that podium and answer Champ's questions. Democratic State Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez, who had voiced an objection to Champ's original question, then stood up and said Rivera didn't need to answer any questions at all. Rivera, still standing by the podium, asked Gowan, "Are you trying to intimidate me here?" Gowan said Rivera either needed to answer Champ's question or he can stand all the way out of the committee room. He then turned to Gonzalez and told her to sit down. Putting her hands on her hips, Gonzalez refused. Gowan asked her if, "You're going to disobey the chair," at which point Gonzalez demanded that the Senate rules attorney be called into the room to weigh in on just what the chair can do. Gowan maintained that Rivera needed to answer Champ's question or leave. Rivera took option B, watching the rest of the hearing from the lobby. Last week, Rivera decided to leave a hearing of the same committee over another slate of anti-immigration bills after another activist was kicked out for a disruption. The rules attorney finally arrived and sided with Gowan, saying it is appropriate for him to keep decorum however he sees necessary, and that it's up to the chairman if Gonzalez could stand or not. The rules attorney also said that Gowan could compel a member of the public to either answer a question from a senator or leave. Gonzalez expressed her disapproval, saying, "It is not right to make members of the public answer any questions that they do not want to answer." She asked for a vote to appeal Gowan's answer or leave directive, but was shot down by Gowan. At that point, Democratic Senators Catherine Miranda and Kiana Sears and more than 30 members of the public in the room also rose in protest. They all remained standing for the rest of the committee hearing. Bill advances. Rogers' bill eventually passed out of committee with only Republican votes. Republican Timothy Dunn said the bill was needed because cartels and drug runners are still active, while Rogers blamed undocumented immigrants for the increased cost of housing as justification. But Sears called the bill absolutely ignorant and careless, and Miranda said the proposed law caused more confusion and fear. Sears also told Gowan that she stood because, "I'm disappointed that we compelled a member of the public to actually answer a question," adding that, "I believe that any citizen, anyone who comes in to speak, has the right to come and go as they please." But McGowan doubled down on his decision to compel Rivera to speak or leave, calling it just a rude situation. Virian Serafin, an attendee who also stood to protest Gowan, said after the hearing that the chairman was on a bit of a power trip. "You're not going to silence any of our voices. You're not going to tell us how to speak," said Serafin, who also works for the immigration organizational group Living United for Change in Arizona. "We're not going to allow them to stifle our voices or control it in any way." Reached after the meeting, Miranda told New Times she's going to stand with my colleague and called the demonstration a smaller sense of the atmosphere compared to the nearly daily protests outside the Senate building. "All we have and all we can do is publicly tell the facts. The United States is under chaos, so we have to just keep speaking," Miranda said, adding that the anti-immigration bills are going to get vetoed by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs. "Thank goodness for the veto pen," Miranda said. Neither Schamp nor Gowan responded to requests for comment on the incident. Speaking to New Times after the vote, Rivera thanked everyone who stood, including the three Democratic senators. "The gesture almost brings me to tears and really warmed up my heart that there were so many people standing up for me," he said. Rivera then grabbed a bullhorn from another activist and continued to make his voice heard from the grounds outside the Senate building. "We can't sit back. We can't just idly sit back and say, oh, well, we can't do anything," Rivera told New Times. "We have to stand up." Gila County attorney sued by man axed for Rot in Hell Charlie Kirk post. This next story was written by Stephen Lemons and posted on February 5th. After an assassin killed Christian nationalist commentator and Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk last year, right-wingers successfully drummed hundreds out of their jobs for their supposedly heinous comments about Kirk's death. Some of those people had merely quoted Kirk's own words. Robert Johnson Jr., a legal secretary at the Gila County Attorney's Office, was one of those fired, getting canned by County Attorney Bradley Beauchamp 5 days after Kirk's September 10 murder. The reason? Johnson had posted "Rot in Hell, Charlie Kirk" on his personal Facebook page soon after learning of the killing. Last month, Johnston filed a federal lawsuit against the county over his dismissal, claiming it violated his First Amendment right of freedom of speech. Johnston, who worked in the office's Payson branch processing misdemeanors, also alleges the Beauchamp ginned up false sexual harassment allegations against him when it seemed like Johnston's Kirk post wouldn't do the trick. Johnston is asking the court to reinstate him and to award him unspecified damages from the county and Beauchamp for wrongful termination and retaliation. Neither Beauchamp's office nor Johnston's attorney returned calls seeking comment on the lawsuit. Johnston's complaint describes how, minutes after learning of the Kirk shooting, he took a bathroom break, during which he used his personal cell phone to post his rather tepid message to his friends-only Facebook account. But, the internet being what it is, screenshots of Johnston's post eventually made it up the food chain to Beauchamp, a Republican first elected in 2012 to office in the rural county northeast of Phoenix. In Johnston's termination letter, which was included among hundreds of pages of exhibits in the lawsuit, Beauchamp explained that as county attorney, it was his statutory duty to prosecute such heinous crimes with the support of my staff, telling Johnston that the comment was totally inappropriate and cannot be tolerated. Johnston appealed the decision. In a letter to the Gila County Personnel Commission, he argued that his termination was arbitrary and capricious, and violated both the county's merit system rules for public employees, as well as Johnston's right to freedom of speech under the Constitution. My comment, "rot in hell," is the antithesis of "rest in peace," Johnston argued in his appeal letter. And to infer anything else is to inject your own political presumptions. Johnston asserted that he was a rather low-ranking clerical drudge who didn't even work in the county attorney's main office in Globe. He added that in his more than 2 years in the office, he'd been an exemplary employee with no reprimands. He also cited the 1987 Supreme Court case Rankin v. McPherson, in which the High Court ruled in favor of an employee in a local constable's office who, after the unsuccessful 1981 assassination of President Ronald Reagan, had said, "If they go for him again, I hope they get him." The Supreme Court ruled that the statement was protected by the First Amendment, partly because it involved a matter of public concern, was not a threat to the president's life, in which case it would be illegal, and did not dramatically interfere with the effectiveness of the workplace. As the modern internet did not exist in 1981, the details of the Rankin case differ considerably from Johnston's, but Johnston's impassioned assertion of his First Amendment rights may have given Beauchamp some pause. On September 26th, Beauchamp amended the termination notice, adding vague allegations of sexual harassment involving comments Johnston allegedly made to an unnamed co-worker the previous August. True or not, the allegations opened up a proverbial can of worms for Gila County's top prosecutor. Hoo-has, sugar daddies, and man-whores. According to a transcript of Johnston's October 21st hearing before the County Personnel Commission, the late-coming sexual accusations backfired on Beauchamp. The hearing produced accounts of an office environment that read like a cross between Duck Dynasty and White Lotus, emphasis on the former. In his amendment to Johnston's initial firing letter, Beauchamp tacked on three allegations of Johnston making inappropriate comments to a female co-worker, saying that they were also grounds for immediate dismissal. The comments involved the woman possibly leaving her husband, Johnston offering to be her sugar daddy if she did, and telling her, "If you ever want to take advantage of me on that couch in the woman's office, you know where to find me." During the hearing, Johnston denied that he'd made the comments. He called the accusations absurd and claimed that the county attorney's office was desperate to smear him with false allegations because they knew his First Amendment claim was valid. Ironically, these accusations opened up an unusual line of questioning from Johnston's attorney, Joshua Black, who elicited a surprising admission from Chief Deputy County Attorney Joseph Collins. Under questioning, Collins admitted taking a bet from another prosecutor as to whether he could get the word "hoo-ha" into the court record. "One of our defendants had put drugs in her vagina," Collins told the commission, "and so I made the comment that she had drugs in her hoo-ha." Collins said the other attorney bet him $100 that he wouldn't repeat the phrase "hoo-ha" in court during closing arguments. Collins did, apparently winning the bet. Asked during the hearing if he thought it was appropriate to use the word "hoo-ha" in court, Collins replied, "Judge didn't object. He didn't say anything about it." During another part of his colorful testimony, Collins described his investigation into the sexual harassment claims against Johnston, stating that Johnston has the reputation of being a man whore in the office. That remark allowed Johnston to rebut that characterization during his own testimony. He said it couldn't possibly align with his alleged comment about being a sugar daddy, which Johnston defined as someone who pays for companionship. "You heard testimony that I'm sort of a man whore," he said. "Okay, so I don't have a problem, apparently, getting female companionship whenever I want. But I need to offer someone that I'm going to be a sugar daddy? I don't believe so." Collins' man whore comment caused the commission's chairperson, Krista Dalmullen East, to observe that there might not be the best environment in that office. Commissioner Jesse Leatham quickly agreed. "I was just about to go down that list. We have a deputy county attorney who's made a bet trying to get the term hoo-ha into a closing statement as if it's a joke. The courts are a joke. That sets a precedent for where we are. And that's why I said this behavior occurred, and it probably continues," Leatham grumbled. With egg on face, the county attorney's office agreed to strike the sexual harassment claim before the hearing's conclusion, though it remains a part of the public record in the case. If Johnston's claim goes to trial, the deputy county attorney may get to repeat the word hoo-ha in federal court, though he won't be scoring another C-note for it. Despite ditching the sexual harassment claims, the commission ultimately rejected Johnston's First Amendment arguments. It upheld his termination, finding that his rot-in-hell post was made during work hours and citing testimony from other employees, supposedly bolstering Beauchamp's contention that the post would hurt his office's reputation with the public and cause disharmony among staff. Protected or not? Is telling Charlie Kirk to rot in hell protected speech? For Johnston, it may be. Attorney Alex Morey, a free speech expert with the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Freedom Forum, said Johnston may have a viable claim in large part because he was a public employee. If Johnston had worked for a private company, Morey said, he would have had little or no recourse on purely First Amendment grounds. That employer has their own First Amendment right to decide whether or not they want to be associated with you as an employee, Morey said, adding, they have a right to fire you if you say something that they dislike that doesn't align with their values as an employer. By contrast, the First Amendment constrains government employers in how they can censor or burden speech. But that doesn't mean public employees have carte blanche. The Supreme Court made that clear in its 2006 decision in Garcetti v. Ceballos, which involved a deputy district attorney in the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. In that case, the deputy prosecutor claimed that he had been retaliated against for writing a memo criticizing a faulty affidavit for a warrant. But the court found that the prosecutor's speech was pursuant to the dictates of his job, so the First Amendment did not shield him from discipline. Under Garcetti, government employees acting within the scope of their job duties basically don't have First Amendment rights, Morey said, even if they are speaking on a matter of public concern. In the Johnston case, the court would have to scrutinize the facts to determine what actually happened. Was this employee causing serious workplace disruption, or are we seeing viewpoint discrimination and political retaliation in the workplace? She asked. To answer this question, she said the litigation would have to use the discovery phase to fully flesh out the details of what happened, delving into the emails and texts of Beauchamp and his employees. Considering the testimony of Beauchamp's underlings during Johnston's appeal to the Gila County Personnel Commission, that could prove eyebrow-raising. For his part, Johnston points out in his complaint that nothing in or related to his post indicated he was employed by or had any connection to the Gila County Attorney's Office, nor did it advocate or approve of any unlawful conduct. Neither was there evidence that the post was known to the general public in Gila County, or that it impaired or was likely to impair the efficiency or operations of the Gila County Attorney's Office. The complaint notes that Beauchamp testified at the appeal hearing that he interpreted Johnston's post as celebrating the murder of a man in front of his wife and children, though it adds that Kirk's family members did not actually attend the event where he was killed. Per his complaint, Johnston suffered prejudice by being falsely accused of sexual harassment. It also says he suffered a reduced standard of living and becoming more isolated, living in the small community of Strawberry, embarrassment and humiliation from being fired, worry about how he can support himself, sadness and emotional distress from the loss of his job and the highly valued relationships he had enjoyed with his coworkers at the Gila County Attorney's Office. Johnston is still unemployed, his complaint alleges, and has poor prospects for finding suitable new employment near his residence in Strawberry. Johnston claims that he has applied for numerous jobs as a paralegal, but so far has not gotten a single interview, and is subject to compelled self-publication when he is asked about his employment history and must truthfully admit that he was fired from his last job. As a last note, Johnston's complaint points out that the hateful words "rot in hell" have been freely and openly spoken by the current president of the United States about his political enemies. Then again, U.S. presidents, especially the current one, can get away with much more than county legal secretaries. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.